the leadership of the chair, Mr. Manuel. You're welcome. I know that IDC will be coming in later, but I think it's also proper to welcome them together with their leadership, the chair of the board, Mem Mabuza, and the CEO, Mr. Qhina. You're welcome. Yes, this is the time of the year where we're considering the departments and their entities' annual performance reports. Included in there is the audited financial statements of the departments and the entities. For now, I think we'll be considering that of the Competition Tribunal. We're not going to waste more time with many remarks, but just to go straight to the presentation. Mr. Manuel, I think we have, you know, everyone's here. The committee still as it was, as you left it. We haven't changed. Even our support staff is as is, as you know them. So we'll allow you the opportunity to give us a summarized version of your report. Thank you.
Chair, thank you very much. And you know who we are, but just to remind you, I'm Norman Minoy, I'm the chairperson. Lerato Motawong on my left, the registrar, and on her left, Janine de Klerk, our chief operating officer. Chair, just a personal note, if I can just thank you and the committee for moving our presentation to Thursday to accommodate me. It's greatly appreciated. Thank you. Just to go on to my first slide, we basically will do a brief case review.
Just a minute, Mr. Manon. I just wanted also to welcome, just a special welcome to Mr. Titlek's son. I think we should encourage them. They are young and they must grow up knowing what we're doing here. This is an opportunity for you to see Parliament in action. We welcome you. We know that we heard that you are a doctor by training, and we want to wish you all the best. And sorry that your studies had to be disrupted, but all the best. These are honorable members here and honorable leaders of the institutions, just like your mom. Thanks, Jenny, for bringing her.
Thank you, Chair. So what we'll do, just to give you a breakdown, I'll do a brief case review of the more important cases. Motawong will do a performance review, Janine de Klerk will do a finance overview, and then I'll end with a few challenges that we're facing at the moment. Just to remind you, we are the court arm of the competition authorities. You heard earlier this week from the policeman stroke prosecutor, which is the commission. And we deal essentially with, we can divide our types of cases in two, merger cases and prohibited practice cases. By prohibited case practice cases, I mean the cartel cases and the abuse of dominance cases. So if I can start off with mergers, and in my annual report I'd say that this past year has been the year of the merger, and I should perhaps explain what I mean by that. Is in the past year, that was the 2015-2016 year, we heard more mergers than we'd ever heard of in the history of the institution. That's 17 years. We cleared 133 mergers, and I can't tell you why we had got so many this year, but it is more than we've ever had in the past. So that's why we call it the year of the merger. And then I'm going to deal with some of the more high-profile ones happen to be in the telecommunication sector. Again, they all happened more or less at the same time, and sometimes it's difficult to ascertain why they should be happening then. Perhaps there's a sort of copycat response to others. And then the other thing we'll deal with, three cases came up this year dealing with the question as to whether certain transactions were mergers or not, because if under our system, if it was a merger, the transaction had to be notified, and we had three quite high-profile transactions in which this question arose. Two involved subsidiaries of the big NASPERS group, and in the one case, the one we heard first, a rival, Caxton Publishing, said that the printing operations of the NASPERS group, which had been jointly owned with somebody else, had been restructured for a public listing, and this constituted a merger. We heard the case. We determined that technically it wasn't a merger. The case was appealed, and the appeal court decided the other way and said it was a merger. The second case also involved an NASPERS subsidiary, this time involving MultiChoice and the SABC. It's a transaction that has been very much in the news lately. And the question was whether a transaction which MultiChoice bought exclusive rights to the archives of the SABC for a five-year period and acquired certain other rights was a merger for the purposes of the Act. Again, we determined on the fact that we had that it was not a merger. This case was again appealed. The appeal court split on the issue, and two of the judges were agreeable with us that it was not a merger. One of the judges thought it was. But the judges have required that the parties must give certain information to the Competition Commission so that it can do further investigation in case there's further evidence to suggest that it is a merger. At the moment, that investigation is still ongoing, so I can't report any further on the outcome of that. But if the order is such that if the Commission decides on the documents that it gets that this is a merger, it will require the parties to notify to us. If they don't wish to do so, we'll again have the same dispute. The third battle over what is a merger, also high profile, was a hostile bid for a company called Sovereign Foods by a rival chicken producer, and we had to decide whether voting rights obtained by Country Bird, which allowed them to possibly veto a special resolution, constituted control and therefore a merger. Again, we decided it was not a merger, although our panel split 2-1 on this decision. So a lot of these classifications of mergers are difficult things, and different people have different views on it. They haven't appealed that decision, but I understand that dispute is still ongoing. Insofar as the telecommunications mergers are concerned, there were three major ones that emerged in the year in the past year. The first one was the merger between Vodacom and Neotel, second MTN and Telkom, and the third Telkom BCX. Now, the only one of them actually proceeded, and that was Telkom BCX. What's interesting about this merger is it had been prohibited several years ago by the tribunal. So this was a sort of second time round merger. And this time round we cleared the merger, but there were a number of conditions imposed on the merged firm to deal with concerns by the downstream, in other words, the internet rivals of Telkom and BCX, to meet their concerns. And there was also public interest in job losses, which was the subject of a condition. However, the two other mergers, MTN Telkom and Vodacom Neotel, were abandoned. The Telkom MTN was abandoned after the Commission finished its investigation and recommended prohibition. The parties didn't go further. Vodacom Neotel was approved conditionally by the Commission, when it came to the tribunal phase, everybody else in the industry jumped in and objected to the merger, and it also received certain concerns from both the Economic Development Department and the sector regulator, ICASA. So we had all these parties around the table having concerns about the merger. So we spent quite a lot of our time actually trying to regulate this merger to get it on track, to make sure the thing ran. And as everybody knows, eventually the merger was withdrawn for reasons that haven't really been articulated at any length publicly, but it was a huge demand on the resources of the tribunal to be able to run a case of this size. I think that we were ready to hear this and deal with it and deal with all the procedural issues that it raised, but it was withdrawn. So we haven't seen that merger. And in fact, what subsequently happened was that the sector regulator, CASA, which had given approval to the merger but not considered the competition commissions, had its decision set aside by the High Court because it said it needed to decide the competition issues as well. So it has been a difficult transaction for the public authorities. Let me go a little bit more quickly about some of the other mergers. I just want to mention these two mergers because they're an example. The committee sometimes asks us, well, are we and the commission always of the same view in relation to mergers? And here were two that we were not of the same view. So Clover and Nkunzi was a merger that the commission had actually initially prohibited. And basically, Nkunzi is a firm that if you go to Woolworths and you buy something called Ayrshire Milk, they are a company that that contracts with farmers to produce the special milk, and they were merging with Clover, the largest milk producer. So there were some concerns about this particular merger. The commission had decided to prohibit it. When it came to the tribunal by way of what we call a reconsideration, the parties gave up a number of conditions that they weren't willing to give to the commission, but they gave to us, which protected both farmers and other suppliers of the customers, and there was an employment condition. On that basis, we cleared it. The opposite way around happened with Pioneer Health and Future Life. If you eat something called ProNutro, a famous South African staple, Pioneer Foods makes ProNutro. Future Life makes a kind of instant porridge, which is very like ProNutro, although they say it is healthier than ProNutro. And Pioneer Foods, in other words, ProNutro, was buying Future Life. The commission cleared the merger without any conditions. A rival, Kellogg's, intervened and said it was... Kellogg's intervened and said it was concerned about this merger. Kellogg's is a rival maker of breakfast cereals. And we had a hearing, and it took several days, and eventually we allowed the merger but imposed certain conditions to ensure that the ProNutro brand was being preserved in the market for a period of 2 years, so that competition between those two products was retained for a period. On the cartel front, on the practice front, the major case was a case involving Media 24, again a member of the NASPERS group, so they've had a busy year before us. And on the cartel front, there were no major cases before us by way of contested hearings, but we had to decide a number of procedural issues in relation to cartel cases, which become, as it were, precedents for other cases as we go forward. As far as the Media 24 case is concerned, this was a very lengthy case involving what seemed to be a very minor market. This was a market for community newspapers in Velcom, so this would not be the most lucrative market in the world, but the allegation was that Media 24 had two publications in that market, and they were using the smaller one to price its advertising very low to drive out a rival publication called GoldNet News. And eventually we concluded, after quite a long hearing with lots of technical economic evidence, that in fact Media 24 had been guilty of what's called predatory pricing. They'd contravened the Act. And this is the first predatory pricing decision we have made since the Act came into being. However, we found them to have contravened a provision of the Act for which a fine is not available as a first-time offence. So what we had to decide more recently was what was an appropriate remedy against a firm which couldn't be fined. And we came up with what we considered to be quite an innovative remedy, and we required the NASPERS group, which owns Media 24, to give rival publications in the Velcom area 90 days of credit from both their printing and their newspaper distribution wings, both of which are active in the Velcom area, to rival publications. The reason being is that the biggest barrier to entry for rivals is to get their money in for advertising before they have to pay their printing and distribution costs. And so that's the remedy we have imposed. If a rival accepts this within 2 years, it will have this facility available for a period of 3 years to get it up and going. Now, what's happened since then is that Media24 is appealing our decision on the merits. In other words, the finding that they were guilty of predatory pricing, but they are not appealing against the remedy, which they seem to be able to live with. The Competition Commission, in response, has said, we are cross-appealing on, we are happy with the merits, but we're cross-appealing on the remedy, which we think is too low, because the Competition Commission had wanted us to impose a investment remedy on Media24, that they must actually pay for a new rival to enter the market. We felt that remedy wouldn't work for various reasons that we gave in that decision. So that's the Media24 case. That would be the major prohibitive practice case of the year. On the cartel front, as I said, most of these cases get settled by way of consent orders. A consent order is when the Competition Commission and the respondent firm enter into agreement to settle the case, and we then just have to see that the order is a reasonable one. It's equivalent of the plea bargain in criminal proceedings. And most cases get settled in that way, and it's desirable that they do get settled in that way. There have been one or two cases where we had to decide procedural issues in these cases. One was whether the commission had to give early discovery of its docket in these pleadings before the respondent has to say what its defense is. We found in favor of the commission. That decision was appealed to the appeal court. They've overruled us, and the commission has now taken that decision to the constitutional court, which hasn't yet heard the case. So it's presently awaiting a decision of the court. So those are our case highlights. If I can then hand on to Lerato to deal with the some statistics.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just quickly go through the interesting stats of the past financial year relating to the cases that we dealt with. We've now measuring what we call a major clearance period, and this is the period between when a major is notified to the Competition Commission and to when the tribunal finally makes its decision. So in the timelines are as follows. The commission has 40 business days to do the investigation, and once they've referred the matter to the tribunal has 10 business days to set the matter down for a hearing. After the 10 business days, the tribunal has another 10 business days to issue an order. So in total, it's actually 60 business days to clear a major. And in the past 2 years, we found that you can see that in the 2014-2015 year, that's in the blue, we dealt with a few majors, but as you can see on the left-hand side of the graph, we've cleared more majors within the 60 business days than we did over the 60 business days. And also in the 2015-2016 year, with the orange graph, then you can see that we've actually cleared more majors within the 60 business days than we did the ones that went over 60 business days. In the past year, we decided on 124 large majors. Of these, 72.58 were cleared in less than 60 days, which is the graph that I just showed you. And then the average clearance period was actually 50 days. And in the prior year, that's 2014-2015, we decided on 98 majors, and 69.39 of these were cleared in less than 60 days. And the average clearance period was actually 51 days. We did deal with a lot more majors in this year, and we have actually cleared much more in less than the 60 days than we did. And I mean, even though we have the challenges that we have in terms of our shortage of our members, we're able to clear those in the period that we indicated. As the committee is aware, in terms of our measures, we can approve measures unconditionally, and we can approve measures subject to certain conditions. In the 2015-2016 year, out of the 133 measures that we approved, 28 of those we approved subject to conditions. In the previous year, out of the 102 measures that we approved, 18 of those were approved subject to conditions. This figure just it's just the previous slide, just in a bigger format, and you can just see the percentages that I indicated on the. The Act allows us to impose public interest conditions as well as competition conditions. And in the 28 measures that we approved with conditions in the previous year, 23 of them had only one condition that was imposed, and in five there were a number of conditions that we imposed in a matter. And in 19 of our measures, we imposed employment conditions. In four, we imposed triple BEE conditions. And in nine, we imposed competition conditions. In terms of penalties that were levied against companies for contravening the Act, we imposed fine on 19 firms for collusion. And that would be what Norman alluded to earlier, talking about cartels. And the total number of fines were 337 million. And in one matter, there was a fine of 750 million for a failure to notify a major. So the total number of fines were 338 million. The largest in the previous financial year was 103 million, and that was imposed on Nippon, which is a shipping cartel, and they involved in the shipment of cars from South Africa to different parts of the world, and also from different parts of the world into South Africa. This is just a graphic of the penalties imposed by sector. And in the previous year, we dealt with a lot of transportation and storage cartels, followed by the construction. And you'd know that in the previous year, in the 2014-15, we had more of the construction than we did of any other sectors. Just in terms of the performance review for this financial year, we have 28 targets, of which we measure target on, and that's what we report on to the department on a quarterly basis. 14 of these are on adjudicative excellence, and this is just more on our core function as a competition tribunal, dealing with cases, how long it takes to clear cases and all of that. Seven of those are on stakeholder relationships, and then seven are more on accountability, transparency, and sustainability. In the previous year, we have met or exceeded 17 of these targets. Just in terms of budget allocated and budget spent on the targets, on adjudicative excellence, you can see it has 14 indicators, and the budget allocated to that is much more than the other two. We've allocated about 20.9 million, and in the previous year we spent about 20.2. In terms of stakeholder relationship, we had allocated 164,000, and we've sent about 835,000. And on accountability, transparency, and sustainability, we had allocated 5.8, and we just underspent, and it came to the budget spend was about 5.3, and Janine can elaborate more on the budget when she does her presentation. In terms of adjudicative excellence, we had 204 cases in the past year. We spent about 141 days in hearings, and simply because the numbers are not equal, because on certain days we hear more than one case. We would find that on Wednesdays we deal with what we would call non-complex measures and consent orders, and then we have about five or six in a day. And to 1% of the cases that we had were on large measures and then on consent orders. We decided on 187 cases, and then we issued reasons for our decision in 136 cases, simply because on some of the matters we do not have to issue reasons. Their order is good enough. This is just a graph and a comparison of the orders and the reasons that we issued in the 2014-2015 year, as well as what we had issued in the previous year. Our caseload has, on some cases we've gone up, and on some of the other cases we've just gone down a bit. And then this is also another graph just showing how the graph is moving in terms of like the days we're spending hearings and the days that and the number of matters that we've had, and you can see that it's going up and going up very sharply. In terms of adjudicative excellence, the reason that we're not able to meet some of our targets is simply because when we have to set down matters, we have to check on the availability of the parties. And if we are available to hear matters and the parties are not, there is really not much that we can do. And then we'll have to, then that also means that we're not able to meet some of the targets that we're supposed to meet. And then in other matters, you'd find that the parties bring a matter before us, and then in the process they enter into negotiations with the commission, and then it delays the whole process before the competition tribunal, and as a result, then we're not able to meet our targets as well. And then in some of the matters, the matters are quite complex in the sense that then they need extensive research and deliberation, and then it also delays the writing of the decisions.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I'm going to provide you with a brief overview of the remaining two strategic objectives, stakeholder relationship and the accountable, transparent and sustainable entity, and then give you a little bit of an overview on the financial figures that were presented in the financial statements. So the first one deals with stakeholder relationship, and we've set targets around posting the non-confidential versions of the reasons on the website and then issuing press releases or media statements related to the final decisions of large mergers and prohibited practices. So you'll see we posted 136 reasons on our website during the prior financial year, and 97% of these were posted within 2 business days, which is the target that we've set for ourselves. We've also issued 124 media statements or press releases that related to 134 final decisions. Sometimes we combine a press release for a final decision, and sometimes a final decision is not newsworthy, so we may not always issue a press release. So that's why it doesn't always equal the number of final decisions. And also with our communications officer, we're beginning to focus a little bit more on social media, and while we haven't created a Facebook account, we are using Twitter, but Twitter is limited to the communication officer just communicating to Twitter followers what's going on in the actual hearings in the tribunal, when they're starting and when they're taking place. Then the next slide is just a little interest to show you how many users we have on our website. We monitor the use of our website on a regular basis. So you'll see that last year we had over 38,000 users of our website, with 51% of them being new users. And understandably, the bulk of our users come from South Africa, but then in a decreasing order, you will see the other countries that have made use of our website. Then the next, or the third strategic objective we have is focusing on an accountable, transparent and sustainable entity, which covers good governance, effective oversight, efficient and effective management of our finances, sound controls and sustain and creating a sustainable entity. So with regard to a sustainable entity, we've put a big focus on internships. We've got three long-term interns, and by long-term we mean 1 year, and that's in the case management department, and then we have three short-term interns, or we had three short-terms last year. They come over their vacation, so either over the June-July vacation or the December vacation, and they work in the case management department. We also currently have a part-time intern in IT who started last year and is continuing through. And then we have an intern in registry who also started on a part-time basis, and then we gave him a position for a year as a registry clerk. We've also been collaborating with an organization called Harambee, which is an institution that provides various students from disadvantaged backgrounds opportunities to learn skills and equip them for work in the workplace. So when we've needed interns, we approach them and we take from their pool. And then even if the students aren't given a position, they've at least been through the experience of an interview process. These were just interesting comments for you to read on two of our interns. Boozy is currently a graduate intern, so she started during the prior financial year and she's continuing on. I don't think I need to read out the comment, but it's on the handouts that you've seen. And then Danielle, who was a July vacation intern. So she, both of them have had fairly positive experiences in the tribunal. Then the next slide is just dealing with social responsibility, which is also part of creating a sustainable entity. And we've kind of had a partnership with a school in Mamelodi, a secondary school called Gauteng. Because we're a government entity, we can't actually give them money as such, so we've helped them out in various ways. Staff themselves have made personal contributions in terms of what's needed at the school, like stationery or clothing and that. And then we also donate all our redundant files and stationery to them because they have a real need for them. They're also the school that we're liaising with now at the moment in terms of school outreach, and you'll see, while this didn't happen in the prior year, we're highlighting it here because we know that this particular committee was interested in that area. So this is the letter that was sent to them to make a formal invitation to invite some of their grade 10 and grade 11 students to come to the tribunal and watch a hearing and then learn a little bit about competition law. So we're currently in that process, and we're hoping that by the end of this school term we will have had a group of 10 come to us. There are certain challenges that we face with the school outreach program, and I think they highlighted here. The schools are poorly resourced, and we have to assist them with the logistics. Planning is difficult because some of the schools don't have adequate telecommunications, and then also the question of finding an appropriate case that would be of interest to young school pupils. But despite this, we're continuing, and we've got other schools, if it doesn't work, with Gauteng, and we hope, as I say, to have a group in of 10 by the end of the financial year. This is just a little bit of demographics, just for you to see the staff as at the end of financial year by race and by gender. As you know, we're a small organization of not much more than 28 full-time people. This is just the secretariat. It doesn't include the tribunal members. Then the financial overview, which deals with the other aspects of accountable and transparent around financial governance and other issues of governance. Now, we received an unqualified audit. Unfortunately, it wasn't clean, as we'll disclose later. And there were no findings with regard to the usefulness or reliability of our performance information. In addition, we didn't have any issues of governance or any issues of risk management. We had issues pertaining to fruitless and wasteful expenditure and irregular expenditure, which we disclosed in our financial statements. The fruitless and wasteful expenditure related to two things. One was to pay SARS for a voluntary disclosure process, which is a VDP, where over those, that period highlighted in there, that slide is actually incorrect. It should be the 1st of August 2010. But over that almost six-year period, we had applied the incorrect perks tax code on cell phone allowances, which means the perks tax wasn't being deducted. And this had arisen despite the fact that during that period we did have a compliance review of our payroll, and it was in a second payroll review, compliance review, that the error was picked up. So it was corrected and the money was paid to SARS. SARS waived the penalties, but we had to pay interest on it, so we had to declare that as fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And then there was one supplier that we paid VAT to who was not VAT registered, and we've had to declare that, but we are in the process of recovering that money from the supplier. So that will be reflected as being recovered in the next financial year. Then in the previous financial year, we reported irregular expenditure, which part of it was all related to the project management of our electronic caseware system, which we've demonstrated to this committee before. And we disclosed when we requested condonation from National Treasury that we expected to spend some money this year. So they gave us a condonation on the full amount or the prior year figure and the current year for the project management. We currently have a disclosure that we will be going through to Treasury for condonation for that relates to paying of a consultant who did an organizational assessment, and that figure is for the three-year period up until the end of March 2016, and then some fees that were paid to a travel agent over service fees paid to a travel agent over 2 years. Understandably, this committee would want to know why this irregular expenditure arose, and I think it's a hard lesson that we've learned, but the tribunal incorrectly placed some reliance on a provision and legislation for a sole supplier, and it was, I think, more an interpretation around what a sole supplier was. And we had a different interpretation to what the AG had, so that was declared as being irregular. The other reasons for it are not documenting the reasons and approvals for deviations correctly. So while there may have been proper reasons and proper approvals in place, they're not documented properly. And in order to deal with this, we now have a procurement officer who's been appointed and who's been there for, I think, nearly a year now. We have a much more rigorous approach to deviations. We actually are, as much as we can, avoiding deviations. And then the other issue that pertains to the sole supplier and contracts is that we're opting now to enter into medium-term contracts with service providers as opposed to specific project-based. So previously what happened is you would get a consultant in to do a particular job, and then understandably work would come out of that where there wasn't really anyone else who could continue the work because of the history and the prior work that had gone into doing whatever the project was. So now what we do, rather than saying come and just do A, we say we want to appoint a consultant for a period of 3 to 5 years to do a particular work. And that way then we don't run into this issue with extension of the work. I think what I also need to point out is that we actually are not using consultants that much. So even if we have these contracts, there's not a large amount of them. We had them primarily in the period when we were undergoing an organizational review and looking at capacity issues within the tribunal, and that's where some of it arose. And then the other thing that we've done now, which we've started at the beginning of this year, is that we've upskilling our finance department, and that we're having finance report directly to the COO as opposed to reporting indirectly to the COO and directly to the head of corporate services. Then in terms of our finances that were reported in the financial statement, we received income of 35.44 million, and the breakdown there is in terms of the grant and the filing fees and other income. So 59.01% of our income is from the grant that we get from the EDD. and then filing fees and other income is made up of a number of things, which can include the use of our retained surpluses. As this committee may recall, we have permission to use our retained surpluses over the MTF period. We're drawing it down so that we can fund our budgeted expenditure, and we anticipate that in the next 3 years that money would have been drawn down completely. Then our expenditure was 35.13 million, the bulk of it being on personnel expenses. And this is just a little diagram that illustrates our expenditure, the top graph, and then our filing fees and our grant and our other income. And you can see that our other income stays fairly static throughout the 16-year period that the tribunal has been in operation. The filing fees fluctuate, and that's kind of in a way related to the graph that Lerato showed you earlier on, where the number of matters fluctuate. So you can't have any certainty around the filing fees. It's also not a filing fee that we impose. It's what the commission imposes, and we get a portion of it. And then you'll see that our grant is slowly increasing, but it's not increasing in the same proportion that our expenditure is increasing. So we do have a gap, and which has been funded primarily via our retained surpluses. Then this is just, this graph is, or diagram is also in our annual report. It's just an illustration over the 2 years of showing where our expenditure has been. Again, as you'll see, the bulk of our expenditure is in the red area, which is personnel, and then the smaller focus on the other areas. Then this is just a diagram to show you our actual expenditure against budget. And if you look at it, you'll see that in our early years, we were actually not spending our budget. I think we've either got better at budgeting or we've got better at spending, because we're spending closer to our budget year on year now with a little gap between the two. So I think we're beginning to find our feet. I think you're aware that our budget is difficult because we never have an exact estimate of the number of hearings, so it's all based on history or estimates of what we anticipate the year is going to look like. And then I think now it's Norman's turn to take you through the challenges.
Essentially, I just want to raise the two major challenges that we're facing at the moment, and both relate to vacancies. We have had two vacancies amongst our members now since August 2014. It's something that I've mentioned to this committee before. And the position of deputy chairperson has been vacant since 2012. Now, the problem with the vacancies is that it affects the capacity of the tribunal to be available to hear matters, firstly, as regularly as possible, and secondly, to get its reasons for decisions out within a reasonable period. Now, at the moment, in relation to the first issue about whether we're ready to hear matters when everybody else is ready to hear them, in most cases, there have been a few isolated incidents where this does not hold. In most cases, we've still been able to do so despite the vacancies amongst our members. But that's been more like by good luck than by the be able to work the system to death, simply because lots of cases either people settle or they aren't ready themselves, and so they postpone them. So there isn't a good reason for why it hasn't happened, although it hasn't happened. In relation to writing of reasons, reasons are ending up coming out later than they should be by the efficiency standards that we want to meet. So the effect of having fewer members has been felt there. There's a third aspect, not having sufficient members, is that one of the reasons members serve a term of 5 years, and as happens every time we get members appointed, there are some new people, there's some people who've got prior experience. What happens is if you don't appoint all the members, it means that the newer people coming to the system spend less time working with the people who've got more experience, and that detracts from the kind of efficiency of the system and the passing of skills. In relation to the deputy chairperson, the deputy chairperson has no statutory function other than to be available should the chairperson not be available. So the fact that there isn't a deputy chairperson hasn't thus far affected the functioning, but if something were to happen to the chairperson, if there was no deputy chairperson in office, would be a serious problem for the organization, because the chairperson's function, one of them, is to appoint members to hear a case. And if there's no deputy chairperson available, there can be nobody to appoint a panel, and if there's no panel, the case can't be heard. So although it's not an immediate problem, not having a deputy chairperson in office is undesirable. Those are the challenges we have. The department is well aware of it. As you know, we've raised it with it, and you've been good enough, I know, to raise it in the assembly as well. But those problems remain, and I just wanted to brief the committee about that. I think I had given the committee the indication last time that I was here was that I expected these vacancies to be filled by the end of May. I've been proved wrong on that. So I just wanted to tell the committee that. Thank you. That's the end of concludes our presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Manuim and the team, for that presentation. Obviously, quite a small institution, but with a lot of work to do, very important work for the country. Colleagues, we have received this summary of the annual performance. May we now interact with this? But before we do so, I just want to commend the tribunal for listening. I think, to be honest, they listen to our advices. You can see that now their CSI is quite out there. We're beginning to see the fruits of that, and they're intense, and the reviews here by intense quite encouraging, and we hope to see you doing more on that also. This your area of work is quite a specialized one, we understand, and with the challenges we're having as a country also, it puts even more pressure on you to ensure that you help in producing more and taking in more people to have interest in the work that you're doing. Because we need more of Leratos and so forth in the institution itself. I've looked at your structure and your staff establishment is quite encouraging also. But going forward, really would want to see even much better. Members, here is the presentation. May we interact with it? Dr. Kado? Any other? That it, Siani? Okay.
Thanks, Sharon. Thank you for the presentation. I have two main questions. The one is around... I've got two, but I can try and make a third one if you want it. The first question was around the establishment of the 1.2 billion rand socio-economic development fund involving six construction companies that was announced fairly recently, but which was presumably worked upon in the year under review. And I wanted to know, what was your involvement in the creation of this fund? Is the 1.25 billion rand over and above the 1.4 billion rand worth of penalties that you imposed for collusive practices in tendering in 2013? Will you have any role in the administration of the fund? Who will be checking to see how the funds are spent? And then I also wanted to know very specifically, does this new fund effectively settle potential claims from municipalities and state-owned entities arising out of collusion in the 2010 World Cup? My second question revolves around penalties. I see that penalties declined from 725 million rand in 2014-15 to just over 335 million rand in the current financial year. Perhaps you could explain exactly why there'd been such a significant drop, but I really wanted to know, where does this money go, and why don't consumers get compensated for anti-competitive behavior when, you know, very obviously they are the ones hurt by it? And how do competition agencies prevent companies from hiking up their prices in order to pay the penalties? And then the third question relates to the vacancies. You're right, when you addressed us in April, you suggested that those two vacant part-time posts, as well as the deputy chairperson post, would be filled by the end of May. And I think the minister, if I'm not mistaken, has given you some sort of hope that that might be the case. What can we as a committee do to expedite the filling of those vacancies?
Dr. Kado, just remind us on the, I didn't hear you on the first one. Which fund are you referring to? Is that the construction fund?
Exactly. It was announced this week even, I think. It's a socio-economic
development. Yeah, okay. I just wanted to know the type of fund. Okay. The next, that is clear.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And thank you, Mr. Manoi, for the presentation. These are just clarity-seeking questions in a way, Chairperson. But I think his response will assist more than just myself. The first one relates to the merger between Telkom and BCK. I noted there that the condition there is that job losses are limited to 60 in 3 years. Now, if I understand what the statement is saying, Mr. Manoi, I then ask myself a question. Why in the other measure involving SAB Mila and the other one, one of the conditionality there is that there should be no problems for the workers for a period of 5 years. I know there could be, you know, every case is treated on its merit and so on, but the workers are the workers. So I'm saying it's a clarity-seeking question. Maybe you'll be able to explain why the variance and so on the specific matter of the workers. The second one relates to the irregular expenditure. I'm aware that Mrs. de Klerk explained when she went through the presentation. My concern, Mr. Manoi, is that you are a reputable organization, you know, led by, you know, a very respectable and learned people. Now, I'm looking at those two irregular payments. Don't you think that, you know, mistakes like this one, because, you know, the tribunal, you preside over serious matters. You fight, you know, all these terrible things that are happening, you know, irregular activities and so on. Now, if in the institution, we understand it's a small institution, you don't really have a big staff there and so on, but if you have irregular expenditure of that nature going on, don't you think that it impacts negatively, you know, on your credibility, on your integrity as a distinguished institution of government that is fighting great battles for our people? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Senator Titlan Bata, Honourable Bata.
Thanks, Chair. Chairperson, you said you paid that to a non-paying VAT service provider. Oh, okay, I think I must get closer. I want to believe, Chairperson, that the organization is running a tight ship. I mean, 28 employees shouldn't be a ridiculous exercise to actually be, you know, very competent in all your aspects of life, contending also with the amount of work that we are dealing with. I'm just not in a space to understand how do you pay VAT to a non-vendor of VAT? And I mean, first of all, before a person is even rendered a service provider, there are all sorts of checks and balances. And even when you are able to get into an agreement with a person, you can detect that the VAT is either or the organization is either not paying VAT or not even having a tax certificate. How did you let this one slip? And then the other one, you explain the details of so many of your deals. I'm interested in this construction cartel one with the 12-year arrangement that has been structured. Would you be able to assure us that the consequences of this arrangement will sink down to many affected parties? For instance, there were public monies stolen by this cartel in municipalities. I stay in Echegwini, for instance. Moses Mabhida was built on theft. Somebody stays in Johannesburg and can say the FNB was built on theft if the actual price could never be detected since there was cartel. Now, it's one thing to create tertiary agreements that benefits the offenders, but the damage done by those offenders has to be checked in the same equivalent of the damage that they have actually done. And I'm not able to assess if you, through your advice, you will be able to tell us maybe in the future if there are any socio-economic benefit for any other person who, for one reason or the other, happened to be a victim by way of being a citizen.
Babembata, I think the question is clear. Any other? Wow. Was this presentation that clear? Or is it, I think it's after lunch issues. Okay.
Hey, says Badala.
Send Badala, ne? Okay, I think we must just caution around the fruitless and wasteful expenditure. But I can see this is a historical case. What happened? Because this is ranging from 1st August 2011 to 2016 February. I just want to get more clarity on that incorrect application of PEX tax. If you can just explain it, and I can hear that monies are being recovered, can we be clear as to how much thus far? Because the monies don't seem to be that much, but what arrangements have you made? And what plans do you have in place for future non-occurrence of this? Because if this is going to continue within such a small institution, I'm just afraid that it's a practice that cannot be allowed, and every cent of government must be guarded jealously against being taken for granted. And then secondly, I'm looking at your income. Where would you say other income other than filing fees are coming from? What would you regard as other income? Because it's quite a significant amount, 3.06%. I don't know whether that you had a program that you I think it was Lerato was heading that program. Would you mind reminding us of that program? I think it was a management program of some kind. Or is it a desktop something? Yes. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yes, just an update, just to check whether there's any progress on that. Yeah, just lastly, I think it's the Media 24 issue in the Free State. I know it's not going to be easy for the competition authorities to really prevent something like this, but can't we take decisions that will ensure that in future we don't have people who just mess up people, you know, imagine, you know, businesses or enterprises just to destabilize for them to remain a monopoly. What do you think we can be done through your own decisions that could really ensure that we encourage, you know, more players than letting monopolies discouraging other role players to take part? That's my last question.
I'll start with the questions related to the finance. I think the first question is the more simple one, and that the other income is generally interest that we've earned on our excess funds that we're not using on a daily basis. We put any excess funds we have into the CPD, and then we transfer from the CPD back into our ABSA bank account as and when we need the money. So normally the grants are paid... yes, yeah, because what happens is like the EDD will pay your grant in three tranches and you don't need all the money all the time. So we just make sure we have enough money in our bank account for 2 months' operations and then leave the rest in the CPD so that we can earn interest on it. And then we've got those, that retained income that is a historic figure that is there and that we draw down as well. So it's interest on CPD primarily. That's our other income.
Is that registered with the National Treasury,
yes,
or is it something?
Yes,
okay.
Yes, yeah, no, it is. You have to invest your excess funds with the CPD unless you have an investment policy. And we had an investment policy, but it's safer and you actually earn more interest with your money in CPD than if you put it elsewhere. So it's the Corporation for Public Deposits, the Reserve Bank. Okay, then let's go to the two questions on the fruitless and wasteful expenditure. The money that was paid to a non-registered VAT person, unfortunately, that was one of our tribunal members, and our tribunal members can be paid either through the payroll or through their business. And I think some of these issues are historic issues that we've now put in place. And in the previous, when that first arose, we didn't have proper processes in place to check VAT verification. We now check with every supplier on SARS's website and make sure that they're VAT verified. And we didn't pick up that she didn't have on her invoices a VAT number. So it was drawn to her attention, and it was agreed that we would deduct that money. And I think to date we have recovered about 100,000 of it. We just have to still find out the exact way of treating tribunal members' salaries going forward. It's a question of an internal audit now as to whether we should pay all tribunal members through the payroll or pay them through their companies if they're law firms, and that's how they're getting paid. So hers is almost all been recovered, and it's recovered by work that she's done for us. So she would have got fees for sitting on a tribunal hearing, and that money has now been recovered back via the tribunal. Then the cell phone issue, unfortunately, when Treasury finds, or when the Auditor General finds an issue of financial question, you have to go back to the period that the error first started. So you can't just look at the current financial year that they're doing the audit on. You have to do a historic analysis and go back. So we had to go back right to the first day that the cell phone allowances were introduced as an allowance on people's pay slips and do a calculation. So that the error was first occurred. What happened was it had been correctly taxed, and it had the correct perks tax applied to it. And we had a consultant, a payroll consultant, come in who always comes in, or that particular firm always comes in to assist with the payroll. And for some reason, that code was changed. And we didn't have documented why the code was changed, and we ourselves didn't pick up that the code had been changed. And so when we did one payroll compliance review, it wasn't picked up. And then when internal audit did one during the period last year, it was picked up. And so we had to do the calculation and go back and pay it. So now we've put various controls in place to prevent that happening again. We've put in a control that nobody can change any of those codes on payroll without them being communicated to the executive. And that also we're doing every 6 months, we're reviewing all the codes on the payroll to make sure that they're the correct codes as required by SARS. So that was that particular issue. And then the issue around the irregular expenditure. So irregular expenditure is defined as any expenditure that occurs without proper compliance with legislation. Mm. And the issue here with us was not about how we had spent the money or where the money went. It was that we hadn't had a proper deviation process in place. So while our reasons for using a particular supplier may be well justified, we hadn't documented it very well. And what that means is that there should be a very structured memo that would be signed off by the accounting authority saying why are we continuing to use the supplier, why it's more cost effective to remain with the supplier, not follow a procurement process, etc., etc. And unfortunately, I think the tribunal has, until very recently, been a very small organization. So some of these things slipped through the cracks. And we have now also put processes in place where we have more staff. Previously, we only had 3 staff that dealt with everything that was non-case orientated and non-registry orientated. So they were responsible for finance, procurement, HR, compliance, governance, and we've now upskilled it. So we're hoping that these kinds of problems won't occur going forward. It is a bad tick on in our books, and it does, you know, it does not look good on us. But I think bottom line is that consultant, we didn't pay for work that wasn't well delivered, and the real issue is that we didn't have proper processes in place for documenting these things and noting deviation from regulation. So, and again, in that one, you're not allowed to just look at this year. If we'd only looked at the 1 year, it would have been a small amount, but you've got to go all the way back to the beginning of when you first started using that consultant, and so that's why it adds up. So hopefully this time next year we'll tell you we have a clean audit. So, I think those are the issues on the finance side.
Jenny, if I could just finish, I think in relation to all these issues, there's been no suggestion by the Auditor General that there's been any dishonesty involved by anybody in the organisation, that any consultant paid has any relationship by anybody who works for us, or that the work wasn't needed, or that we've actually paid too much for it. So it's really the question of case of the consultants, whether our approach to the sole supplier discretion was correct or not. And one of the reasons I say that it's been put into context was subsequent to our report last year, we had a long meeting with the National Treasury procurement people, and they subsequently, as it were, gave their letter of condemnation, because I think they were they were prepared to accept our explanation on those issues, otherwise they wouldn't have given the condemnation. If I can then just get to the questions, perhaps what I'll do is deal with them thematically because some questions are joined. The first, in a sense, relates to the construction industry settlements, which both the Honourable Mbata and Honourable Carter have asked about. As far as the fund is concerned, we actually have nothing to do with that fund. Perhaps what I should do is just explain that when a cartel has been found and is found to have broken the law, there are two possible financial consequences. The one is that the cartel pays penalties, which are administrative penalties under the Act. when we considered the cartel cases, we had no regard to any subsequent civil penalty, and the firms were fined based on their conduct without any regard to anything else that took place subsequently. What the second consequence is that those injured by the activity can sue for damages, and that's separate to the penalty. So in other words, you can be liable both for a penalty and for civil damages. And what's happened is that subsequent to our findings around the cartel cases, various firms, various different parties, both private firms and local authorities, have approached us to issue certificates, which we can do under the Act, to say, you have found this particular contravention has taken place. And armed with that certificate, they can approach the High Court to claim for damages. And that's what's happened in the case of the construction cases. And then there was a joint negotiation with the government, as it were, centrally representing the public authorities and the construction firms to reach a settlement, but we were not party to that and can't give you, an informed further answer to that. But I can say that the subsequent civil penalties have no bearing, civil damages settlements, if there are settlements, have no bearing on how we assess the fines. And we assess them beforehand, before the civil damages happen, and independently of that. In relation to what the Honourable Barter was saying, well, what about poorer people who are affected and who can't necessarily afford lawyers? Well, our law, quite recently, there have been cases from our higher courts which have now recognised a class action to bring damages, and which can be brought in cartel cases. It emerged in one of the bread cartel cases, and they eventually settled out of court, so I'm not privy to what that settlement was. But just to give you an example of how big these civil claims can be, in earlier in this year, the High Court announced a judgment in a case brought against SAA by liquidators of formerly Nationwide Airline, and SAA was found liable for damages of more than 100 million rand. So it gives you an idea that there are vast civil penalties for firms as well as the fines that they had to pay, because SAA already had to pay a fine in relation to that conduct previously. So there is both the penalty enforcement mechanism and the civil damages enforcement action that can be taken against cartels. And because there is a class action, the little guy who is the victim and perhaps on his own can't bring a case, or his damages are too small to justify bringing a case, the class action, there are law firms now specializing in class actions. Clearly they do it for their own benefit because they get a good fee from it, but there is an ability to bring some redress to those who suffered from the cartel action. It isn't as if there is no blame. Now, it's an evolving area. We're at the infancy of this, but we will see more of it coming to place. In relation then to the Media 24 case, I think the fact that cases like this are being brought by the Commission, and the Commission had to fight a very, very hard battle and put huge resources into this case against a well-resourced firm. The fact that the Commission has shown willing to take on these sorts of cases against big guys and that it can win those cases, I think sends a message out into the marketplace that predation is not something that a firm can embark upon lightly, and there will be consequences for that conduct. So I think the very enforcement action itself has been productive. What will happen on appeal, I can't comment on. That will go to the appeal court, and they will make their own decision on the matter. But the Commission will certainly be before the appeal court and will put its case forward for why the findings should still hold. In relation to Telkom BCX, you're quite right. If you looked at our annual report, we report on the public interest conditions, and you'll see there have been different amounts in relation to employment, that firms say guarantee that not many X jobs or X plus Y jobs will be lost. There isn't a consistent number, and as you identified, each case has its own facts. But essentially, the difference between the Saab Miller and the Telkom BCX was that there was no overlap in the Saab Miller ABR InBev in relation to employment, because AB InBev had no production facilities in the country, and so perhaps they were willing to give a remedy that didn't have a huge amount of bite as far as it was concerned, because it had no it had no production facilities, and so that's why it gave it quite a very, very strong concession to firstly the ministry, and then that became part of the order. In relation to Telkom BCX, there was a considerable overlap, and although I wasn't on that panel and can't speak specifically to the facts, is that we have a heightened concern about jobs at the lower part of the lower paid employees, because they're less likely to get a job afterwards. And these jobs that were conceded may well have been high level IT jobs at the top of the people who could get a job elsewhere, and hence there was that particular concession. But I can't take it further in that case, but I can say in relation to other cases where there has been a number that has been conceded, it's either between the high level of employees or the firm that is being bought is in trouble, in fact has to downsize in order to remain in the market. So I don't want people to think that just because there are employment conditions that you can never retrench as a result of a merger. We look at each case specifically and look at the rationale. If the burden is on the firm to justify the rationale, if the rationale is weak, the conditions will be imposed. And sometimes we look particularly at a case and say, look, the lowest level of employees, the public interest is greater than to somebody who's at the top and may get a job sooner than another case. And I think that may have been the distinction in the Telkom BCX case, certainly from the Sav Miller case, where there was no overlap whatsoever. Then I was asked about the drop in penalties. I think that the penalties are just depends what comes up in the particular year. I think one year was quite high because we were seeing all the cartel cases. This year we've seen a number of cartel cases in the furniture industry, but they are small firms with small turnover and fairly reduced. As you all know, there is a proposed settlement with the Commission and ArcelorMittal, which is, by the way, we're going to hear in. I know the committee was interested in that. On the 16th of November, that is going to be heard. So if you want to observe that date, that's when it's going to be heard before us. And that at the moment, the proposed penalty is $1.5 billion, so that would be the biggest we've ever had. So just a matter of what's happening at a particular time, that there's no otherwise pattern that I can identify with that. Finally, as a result of the question of our vacancies, perhaps like the committee to keep raising this with the department. I think it's a difficult issue for us, and there's a limit to what we can do, because we these are not appointments, as I explained before, that we can make. They are made by the president on the advice of the minister, and ask the committee to keep raising that with the department. So that would be appreciated. Thank you, Chair. I think I've dealt with everything.
Thank you, Mr. Manoy and the team. I'm just worried about the audit outcome issues. You have an audit unit. Why is it, I know that these are external people that you've outsourced, but the fact of the matter is some of these issues should have been detected earlier. Why do they wait until now to be detected? I just don't understand when you have people that you pay to do that particular work. I mean, you have a risk committee, you have an internal audit unit and the committee. Those people are supposed to be looking at these things and advising you on such issues. And even detecting them before the Auditor General called, just to understand what are the issues there.
It's difficult to answer that, because the one issue, the cell phone, the perks tax on the cell phone, we did in between that period, August 2010 and February 2016, we had two payroll compliance audits. And in the one that they did in the earlier period, they picked up another issue pertaining to, and it was to do with a change in law about the taxing on insurance, life cover paid by the employee, and they fixed that one. But the cell phone was not picked up. I think the other issue is that When you do an internal audit, it doesn't focus on every aspect of your work. It focuses on the areas that are high risk areas. And so, if a particular area like payroll has not been identified as a high risk area on our risk register, then it won't necessarily be something that is audited in that period. The other problem is that the Auditor General comes in every year with his external auditors, and he sometimes doesn't pick up something until 3, 4, 5 years down the line. And even if he does that, you still have to go back and undo everything in the prior period and declare it as irregular for the entire period and not just in the year of that audit. So I think it's up until recently, procurement was not an issue. Procurement has become more of an issue, I think, just also because of procurement regulations generally. And so it's become an area that we are now focusing on much more tightly, and one of the reasons why we brought in a procurement officer, and one of the other reasons why we now have procurement reporting to finance as opposed to reporting to corporate services, so that there's a tighter link between finance and procurement, and you can have another control in place where prior to paying, finance is checking that everything that procurement has done is also correct. So I think, you know, I think it's just the nature of the audits and the nature of what has been problems is not always the same every year. So the focus changes, and then also changes in regulation, and part of it is also a different interpretation of the legislation, as Norman explained, with the sole supplier, which was one of the issues that National Treasury condoned. And then the other is, while we felt we had documented a deviation, the Auditor General didn't feel it was substantive enough. And so it's also about us improving on our processes. So we need to be much more diligent and much more thorough when we motivate a deviation as to why we're not following the procurement process. And I think those are in place, and that's why I say I'm hoping we won't have any of these issues peeking through again in the next couple of years.
You know, I'm sorry to say this, Mem Titlek, but I'm just a bit worried the way you're taking this audit issues. To me, it's like it's a by-the-way thing in terms of your response, and I don't think it should be, the attitude should be like that. I think it's a legislated matter, and it needs to be taken seriously, so that when you pay your external auditors, because these are supposed ordinarily to be your internal unit, but because of the your structure, that's why I guess you decided to procure external services on that particular for that particular work. But the fact is that they're supposed to be looking at all aspects of, you know, the work of the entity, not just the financials, everything, not just also the performance, everything related to that. And then I'd be able to identify the risk and then report to the audit committee, because hence I'm saying these are supposed to be detected even before the Auditor General comes. We can't blame the Auditor General. The Auditor General has to ask questions. And if they are not, through the management letters, satisfied with what you're saying, they obviously have to issue an opinion. And that's what they are doing. This is something that I think you must take seriously as the competition tribunal, because it is a like we're saying, you know, your institution is quite a small one. And to us, it shouldn't be as complicated as that. But maybe also the attitude needs to change. The other issue I wanted to find out, you know, there seems to be a trend of companies going for appeals, and then they win the appeal. Is there something wrong, or is there anything that can be done perhaps to ensure that, because most of these companies are quite big companies with financial muscle, is there anything that we can do that perhaps to deter such actions? Because maybe they found a loophole somewhere, and as they find loopholes, we need to tighten. So as policy and legislation implementers, perhaps you can guide us as to which areas should we perhaps look at so that we continue to protect our people from abusers.
Chair, I think on the appeal side, you know, people have got the right to appeal in our system, and you know they're entitled to do so. And our system also allows people to go both to the Competition Appeal Court and thereafter to the Constitutional Court. Just so happens that a lot of the firms who are the respondents in these cases are well resourced, and the financial consequences are huge. So if you can get fined off 10% of your turnover, you've got nothing to lose by appealing that decision. Can we do much about it? Well, you know, that's the system. At the end of the day, I think having that right makes the system, gives the system integrity that there are checks and balances. Sometimes the courts will be stricter than we have in some cases, like in the mergers. Other cases, they will overturn us in relation to certain definition of the Act. So it's hard to give a more generalised answer. Is there some gap in the Act that is not being covered? I think the minister is contemplating some amendments that have happened in relation to some practices like excessive pricing, where the courts have given decisions overruling the competition authorities over a series of time. That is one area. I think otherwise, it's too much of a mixed bag to say this is a hole in the thing that needs to be remedied at this stage. But at the end of the day, I think it's important that people have their right of appeal, and sometimes the court will see something differently to the way we've seen it, and that so be it. This is part of our legal system generally. You know, courts make decisions every day that might get overturned and appealed. It's part of the system generally.
Okay, I think it's like you're saying the kids have rights and the Bill of Rights, and therefore them, everything must leave them to exercise their rights. And I think we must keep on looking for solutions. We cannot just give up like that. Yes, people have money. It's our role as government to ensure that we close those gaps. And we need to really do some. It's either there's something we're doing that's not tight enough, hence they are able to appeal and win these appeals. Maybe we need to also understand how many of such appeals have, how many appeals ever since we took these decisions have been won by those appellants. I think we need to check that so that we can check whether this exercise now we are doing is just for the sake of exercise, or is there an impact that we're making out of it. But otherwise, I guess there's no more interest in asking questions from members or follow-ups. Let me take this opportunity really to thank you very much for the presentation and for the good work. The questions as posed do not suggest in any way that you're not doing your work, nor we're not happy about the work that you're doing. Just a matter of ensuring that everything is tight enough, and you continue to do the good work as you do. Thank you very much for that. Members, can we have at least 10 minutes break, and then we'll come back for the IDC? Tea. Do you have fresh water?
They were probably taken on the same date. Ne? Not to be teaching such a plain old car. Hey, Baba, who's your God? Hey, Uzile Chu Mtabelingana is voted as the best city for Moti in Africa.
Oh. Mm.
So cool is my plan. Zoyitola
ikhona le mithi. Ingalahleki.
Ingalahleki. Baqaba nabantu babangani nalolu ntombazane.
Yophepha lokugqibela le lenzeka. Angiyazi lenani.
Olo sisinto kungafanele alithole.
Mari ngoku ingathi yaxolisa ukuthi beke fana alina.
Alinango. Confidential. Eyi. Phela lezi zinto ey'njengalezo kumele nibatshelele ababemida bengena.
Hayi aba bazifakayo kufanele bayazi.
Angiqashiwe njengokontraka, ngingayihambela noma yinini. Yabona, mase ngibonile nje. Angiyena ukontraka phela mina.
Yini
ukontraka? Yebo, sithabile.
Ibona
labo bantu bekhoramu. Ngingazibalekela njengenzeka ikhoramu. So, yebo labo bantu bekhoramu.
Yeah,
but...